Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2. I'm John Norman, and today you'll be hearing from former England fast bowler Steve Harmison and also a bloke who's been up all night watching Australia lose to India, Jared Kimber. And that's where we're going to start this week. India levelling up the series in Australia in thrilling fashion. A century from standing captain Ajinkya Rahane, a debutant fast bowler stealing the limelight, the second coming of Keith Miller, possibly, and news that the New Year's Test is set to go ahead as scheduled in Sydney, although the visitors will have to make do without another fast bowler. So, will it be Warner to the rescue? Will it rain throughout? Or will there even be a call-up for a surprise Indian living in and around the New South Wales area? Who knows? But the series is alive, that's something to celebrate, and we will celebrate here on the Cricket Collective. Okay, Jared, so India eventually winning a game on day four at the MCG. Not one Australian batsman made it past 50. An innings of a lifetime from Rahane, a debut to remember for Siraj, coming-of-age test again for Bumrah. We even got to see Jadeja's trademark celebrations. Absolute brilliance from India, but pretty poor from Australia, and Tim Payne wasn't holding back after the match. But considering where India were, at the end of the first test, 36 all out, no Shami, no Kohli. The manner in which that they dismantled Australia in the second test, as a cricket historian, where does this victory rank in India's history?
Well, they don't win in Australia very often, realistically. So any win in Australia for them is quite high. I think coming off the 36, I think it's more of an emotional thing because we know that India were actually winning that test until they were bowled out for 36. So they were never that far behind in that particular game. But coming to Melbourne, losing your captain, losing your probably most experienced and best bowler, their other best bowler isn't even there. I think it's a huge effort for them to come back. But we talked about
it on the last...
Yeah, we talked about it on the last episode, didn't we? You know, essentially when it comes down to it, a lot of things went right in that 36 spell. I don't think Australia bowled any worse on the morning against India, and they just didn't get the wickets. They kept, you know, there was play and misses, there were inside edges, things, you know, a couple of drop catches. Sometimes that's the difference, isn't it? And I thought India tried to get through briefly in the 36, and every time someone played miss, there was an edge to slip. And in this one, there wasn't. So, you know, that's the kind of randomness of Test cricket. When it comes down to it, Australia doesn't have a very good batting lineup. It has an incredible bowling lineup. That is going to win you a lot of tests, but it also means that you're going to go up and down like a yo-yo. And luckily for India, they've got a bit more of a balanced side than Australia. And incredible depth, the ability to be able to bring in the sort of players they did, like Siraj and Shubman Gill, is, you know, most teams would die for that kind of bench strength.
Jared, were you surprised at the toss that Australia decided to bat first after bowling them out for 36? Kohli's 10,000 miles away. You know, in theory, they're in a pretty poor state when you look at the way India were coming off the field at Adelaide. You know, Tim Payne wins the toss with the bowling lineup he's got. You're not being tempted just to chuck them back in and say, right, we're going to knock you over very, very cheaply again.
I think if the exact same situation happened now, they would definitely bowl first. But I think that they had spent well, their entire life watching people play at the MCG and think it is not a pitch that you want to particularly, it falls apart at the end, essentially. So if you can bat first, you can. The thing is that this is a fundamentally different MCG pitch than they usually go up against. It was green. I can't remember ever seeing an MCG pitch green. I didn't know they were allowed to have green grass in the MCG. Even most of the grass around the ground at the MCG, as you will know, Harmy, is painted because it's basically just a sandy outfield. So you don't get greenery there. So I think they were probably a little bit spooked by that. Australia's not really a bowling first place or a bowling first cricket culture, even less so than many other places. So I think all that came against them. But yeah, if you're doing it purely on strategy and the fact that you just rolled them for 36, I think it would have been a good idea to put them in first. But I don't think that's not what cost them the game. What cost them the game is they fundamentally can't make runs. They haven't made runs in any of the innings that they've had a chance so far. And realistically, they couldn't make runs in Adelaide when India dropped them 1,000 times. So we know that they're not of that level.
Talking about the catching, we were talking last week about the new breed of modern bowler, which can hit a length, can bowl consistently over 90 miles an hour at first and second change. And I suppose what we saw from that robotic almost style of play, using the data to work out a batsman before they've even got to the ground, saw the fallibility, didn't we? I've often watched baseball and thought baseball as a sport would be 100 times better if the fielders weren't wearing those massive mitts. Because when the ball goes in the air, there is a sense of jeopardy, no matter the easy nature of the catch. But in baseball, every single time the catch is taken, pretty much. In cricket, that is not true. And so it proved again. India dropped a lot of catches in the first test. Australia dropped a lot of catches in the second. It frustrates when it's your team dropping them. But boy, does it add to the drama.
Catching is very, very difficult when it comes to different grounds you go to. And especially in Australia as well. If you've got a full crowd in Australia, the viewing, seeing where, through people, and it is very, very difficult. Ball comes to you a lot faster. But when you've got empty seats, then you've got somebody sitting two rows and you're going, you're not sure if you have to be sort of 10, 15 yards away from the bat, to be 12 yards away from the bat. Yeah, the angle you have to move at, there is somebody sitting basically in a seat where you are, watching the nick and watching the sort of side of the bat. Then all of a sudden, if there's somebody moves or somebody's around, so it's very, very difficult. Catching in the slip area in any form of cricket is very, very difficult. And it comes down to preparation, it comes down to practice. We've just had a Boxing Day test match. Did the preparation suffer because you had Christmas Day, you had Christmas Eve and things like that? And they'll say, well, people will listen to this and say, well, surely that should just be in the mind, the robotic. You just catch it. It doesn't always work like that. You have to practice at it. And, one of the best catchers I've ever put, the best slip fielder I ever played with was Triskothek. And Triskothek would have, before a test match, he would have between 50 and 100 catches at slip. Stand then, take 50 to 100 catches every single day of his test match, of his innings. And you think, that's a lot of catches. That's why Trez didn't drop any, because his preparation was ridiculous. Now, when you look at something like India, you've got a different wicket, a different person at second slip. Kohli doesn't always go in there. He comes out of there. And that sometimes can change the dynamics of where you're at. During my time, I'll go off experience. If you had Triskothek and Flintoff, all of a sudden, the two lads there, big lads, used to cover a wider area. Mm. You take them two out and put in, maybe it's in 2009, you had Cook and Strauss. All of a sudden, the gap is not as big, and you put Pryor in there and you don't put Jones in there. So it works. It works with the system, with what you go with either side and what you feel comfortable with and the boundaries that you can cover. So it's not as simple as just saying, go out and catch it, because it is very, very difficult when you're in them position, especially when you're under pressure.
Mm. I've got some, and I've always had this theory about back-to-back test cricket. I was reading your email that you send out, Jared, about momentum. I've never believed in momentum either. But what I do feel, and Harmy, be interested to hear what you have to say, at the start of your test career, on average, how many days would there have been between two test matches? As a kid growing up in England, it was clockwork. You would play the first two test matches. The test would finish on, would start on a Thursday. Forget the Sunday off and the rest day. Forget that for a minute. But you start on a Monday, you'll finish on a Tuesday, and the second test would always start a week Thursday after. Okay? Then the second test would be Thursday, Monday. And then the third test match, or possibly the fourth, they would add another week. So you would essentially have 2.5 weeks between the third and fourth test match. Now, I imagine when you started, that would have been a kind of a similar kind of gap between test matches. I'm not sure what it was towards the end, but I often feel with the nature of back-to-back tests and what is asked of a participant, it asks so much of a player to play in a test match. Two things happen. Firstly, if you're Tim Payne and the Australian team, right, after that demolition of Australia, of India, you've got the singing of the anthem, you've got drinks all night, you bask in the adulation of the newspapers singing your praises the next day with your feet up, trying to take a little bit of a breather. But before you know it, instead of being able to properly recover and recuperate, to compartmentalize what has happened, actually dissect and digest what's gone on, you're back out on the field. And that's where we get this seesaw kind of nature of cricket, because the Australian team don't want to be back out on the field. They've just been told that they're heroes. And now they've got to do it all over again. That's very difficult. The Indian team probably do want to be back out on the field because they want to get what's happened behind them. And, you know, this is their opportunity to actually correct some wrongs. But the other thing that I always feel is, mentally, when are you going to actually relax? Mentally, you're going to relax possibly when you're in the field. It's the only time where you can just switch off for a nanosecond. And that contributes to catches going down, because if you're not switched on, if you're not mentally fresh, the split second it takes for the catch to come your way and for you to put it down, that's the difference between a fully fit and energized and refreshed cricketer and one that's at the end of the day knackered.
Well, that's the point of preparation time leading into your first test match,
you know, which is why I find watching cricket, the visiting team, they're on their game much more in the second test than the first test. That's not rocket science. That's obvious. But India, in the second test, they're acclimatised to the conditions. You know, watch Aussie batsmen. Whenever they walk out onto the field, what do? They look at the sky, don't they? Mm. They get their eye. They get the light. So they're in focus. So it's all working out on the field. And you see it. Visiting teams, no matter the country, by the time you get to that second match, they're so much better. They're so much more on it than they are in the first test.
But you've also, when you say that, you mentioned there the freshness of in being fit and strong. I remember when Vaughan took over as captaincy, we went to Bangladesh, and the first thing he did was, and I mean, it was like marathon. We were flogged before the first test. And he wasn't bothered what happened in the warm-up games. Couldn't care how many overs lads bowled, you know, as long as they got through before play, after play, you were flogged. And I mean, ran, you know, they're nuts off you. And it was basically down to, right, when we get into competition and we get into test match mode, we are going to be as fit and as strong as we possibly can, because people like that don't make mistakes. You know, if you're fit and strong and you've got, you know, a high level of fitness behind you going into a series, your skill level will come through by the end of it. But if you are not fit, if you're overweight, if you are, you know, there's a little question mark on, you know, a little niggle, then all of a sudden you keep playing catch up, and that's when mistakes come in, and that's when you get injured, and you find yourself pretty much out of the team. So I think that has a lot to do with tours now, where the shorter you can go back to back, because the lads are a lot fitter now than what they were when I played and the generation before. I think because they play that much cricket, there is so little time before the games, because they're coming from cricket, going into cricket, going on, and I think because of that, because of their level of fitness, is why, you know, why I think the game is better than actually what it was. You're seeing less mistakes. You mentioned about dropping catches, and you mentioned putting pressure on opposition. But I'm with you. Momentum, I don't think is a word in cricket too much. It's how you start, and the minute you start, and if a team starts well, it's very, very difficult to stem the tide, whether that's momentum or not. I don't think momentum coming in from a game before makes a great deal of difference, because they're all world-class cricketers. We've just seen team getting bowled out for 36. And then, you see someone like Rahane going out and getting 100. He didn't think anything about 36. The modern-day cricketer doesn't think about what's just happened. They think of the now, and that's the difference for me between first-class cricketers, cricketers who are average journeymen who will make a decent living up until the age of 35 and then have to work for the rest of their life, are the ones that aren't mentally strong, aren't physically fit enough, aren't possibly technically good enough. The difference between them and the likes of Joss Butler, Ben Stokes, all these big Joe Roots, big superstars, is the ability to switch off and switch on. And sometimes they switch off in the field, but when the ball comes to them, they switch on. The average Joe, he hasn't got the ability to switch back on. And that's when mistakes come in. And then obviously the pressure of the game comes on top of them.
The last time India played in Australia, of course, won the series. That was an Australia side without David Warner and Steve Smith. Well, there's been no David Warner in the first two test matches. And you could be say there's been no Steve Smith either. What's going wrong with Steve Smith? We'll find out when we speak to Jared very shortly. You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2.
Bowling! Left stump, or is he trotting on his stumps? The bowlers have been dislodged. The Indians are celebrating. Whatever way it has been, to Smith, he is gone. Steve Smith. He's a little bit stunned. He can't believe what's happened. He's going to have to leave the ground.
You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with myself, John Norman, Steve Harmison and Jared Kimber. Fresh from India's series levelling win at the MCG. One apiece now after they beat Australia by 8 wickets. The series continues in Sydney and then on to Brisbane. That just doesn't seem right, but that's what's happening. And pleased to say as well, because there was some doubt about whether the third test would take place at the SCG, but it will. Let's talk about Steve Smith, Jared. What is going on with Steve Smith? He can't buy a run, can't bat against Ashwin. And Bumrah got rid of him in the second innings in the second test match. I don't think he's gone. Has he even hit double figures yet?
He's not gone very far at all. I think Hazelwood might have outscored him in this series so far, which is not ideal. It's quite interesting. I'd have to go through all the dismissals, but there's one thing that I think is common, which is that teams have stopped bowling a mile outside off stump to him. Yeah. So England
that's a brilliant point, because the dismissals, I think he's had one caught at first slip, hasn't he, from Ashwin. Yeah. One
bowled round his legs,
which bowlers have tried to do. What was the other one? Oh, leg. Was it a leg slip?
He was caught at leg slip as well.
Yeah. So leg slip. They're completely bowling changed. At the stumps, essentially, aren't they?
And you need to go back to why this happened. I think a lot of it goes back to England had some success against him in 2015 by hanging the ball really wide. But they were in very English conditions. If you remember, when the pitches were a bit more flat, he suddenly looked great again. And so teams thought, well, that's what we have to do. We have to hang the ball wide to him because he's trying to hit everything to the leg side. In the middle of all this, at one stage, it's in one of my old notebooks, I have about 20 pages of different field settings that I've seen to Steve Smith. Just crazy from having two leg slips, to having like a ring of five guys from mid on to backward square leg, all these sorts of weird fields. And teams have basically at times, I remember having a chat with Herschel Gibbs on Twitter about it one day, just randomly, where he was saying, I don't understand why teams just don't bowl more at the stumps to him. And I said, well, teams have tried. It's just that he gets a couple of weight and they usually pull back from it. If you look at the end of the 19 Ashes, sorry, you can actually see where England start to bowl a lot more at the stumps and they start to really attack the stumps. And the thing is, he has to miss the odd ball or mishit the odd ball. And the other thing is, and Harmy, you'll be much better at an expert at this, but you can't control the ball off your pads, off your hip, off your chest in the same way that you can the ball outside of stump. You have the ability in those positions to actually see the fielders to begin with. And also you're playing in front of yourself. Once you start playing on this other side, you're playing behind yourself. So if you're keeping the stumps in play and you're making it so that he can't pick it, we've seen, I think Guptill took an incredible catch off him. I think might have been in the World Cup. England started to attack his stumps more. Wagner went completely at his body and they didn't give him any room there. India have gone back to his stumps, essentially. I'm not saying that he won't overcome this, because I think he's still probably the best run scorer I've ever seen. If not the best batsman, but he's the best modern run scorer I've ever seen. He'll find a way to work this out. But it just means that the game has changed to him again. And before that, what you would get with Smith was, it was hilarious. It was like, we're going to bowl 4 foot outside of stump. All right. Now we're going to bowl only Yorkers at middle stump. Mm. Now we're going to bowl only off cutters. And now we're going to bowl only outswing. And you would have these ridiculous plans where you would watch a game and a team would try five completely different tactics. And he, by the time he was 80, and it just didn't matter anymore. And I think what the teams have done now is that they've got enough analysis on him. They understand he might be able to get away, but if they continue to go at his stumps or his body, they can at least trap him to one side of the wicket. They can plug that side of the wicket, and they're willing to say, okay, he's going to get a couple of boundaries to fine leg because he's Steve Smith. That's who he is. But we're going to keep attacking these stumps and we're going to keep these fields in. And I think that's the big change. It's almost like they tried everything else. And now they're just like, they're trying this weird thing called patience.
Yeah. As well as that, I think the field position is the biggest thing, because you look at second and third slip, it doesn't really get caught second and third. Second slip, possibly, but third slip and gully doesn't really get caught there. So there's no point having them there. So stop the scoring options on the leg side. I think part of the reasons as well they chucked it outside off stump was to try and, you know, if he's not scoring, he's, you know, the game's not getting away from you, and you know, we feel as though we can knock the other batsman over. If we've got Warner out before Smith gets in, all of a sudden we can bowl one side of the wicket. Steve Smith ain't scoring any runs, and all of a sudden he's under pressure because of six down. And I think that was part of England's plan and preparation as well from England, but also from the rest of the world. I just think at this moment in time, Steve Smith's just lost his head. His head seems to be, it's not in sync with the rest of his body, and all of a sudden he's just a little bit off balance at the point of contact. And I think when he does that, when you have people who have got different techniques, they have to be so in sync to make sure that they're in a position to hit the ball at the point of contact, and the balance, the head's in a strong position, you know, the both feet are firmly planted on the ground, and the ability to hit the ball through the leg side, through the offside. And that's my worry with some of the England batsmen, the likes of Dom Sibley, the likes of Rory Burns, you know, people like that. If Lawrence comes in, that would be my worry with somebody like Lawrence. So, you know, Steve Smith is a world-class cricketer. He is somebody who has overcome, like Jared mentioned, four or five different plans at him, a wide-ranging plan to try and stop him from scoring and getting him out. And what has he done? He's had a couple of low scores and he's come back with an 80, 90, 100. That's what world-class players do. He will come back, not a problem. They're talking about him being under pressure. This kid's not under pressure. This kid is one of the best cricketers that's ever played the game. And he will find a way of scoring runs, because that's what world-class cricketers do.
And I just want to add something there, because there's something really interesting that Harmy talked about, which is that you don't need a second, third and gully to him. It's important that to understand just how many wickets go to that cordon. So if as a batsman, you could come up with a technique where you take out the cordon, right? You might have the odd dip like Smith is happening now, but you are taking 25 to 30% of your dismissals away, which is why he averages over 60, and other really good batsmen who aren't, you know, Kohli and Root and Williamson and Baba Azam, they're all on talent, not that much different to him. The difference is he's taken away one of the most major dismissals in cricket. And that's part of his absolute genius. If that means he can get bowled more around his legs and get caught at leg slip more, I think in the long run, he's still going to average more than those other people. But there might be periods and certain pitches and certain bowlers where he does get rolled a couple of times cheaply. It's just that, you know, since 2013, we haven't actually seen him go out.
What about David Warner? There's a clamour to get him back in the side. Whether he's match fit or not, I'm not so sure. But, you know, what people are assuming, I suppose, those that are desperate for him to get in, partly because watching Joe Burns has been torturous, is that we're going to see the David Warner that smashed 100 before lunch or whatever he did at Perth, you know, a few years back, you know, when Australia has absolutely destroyed India. But, you know, does that David Warner still exist?
Well, I mean, he made the big triple century in Australia, didn't he? He's still at home. He's still an incredible batsman. That said, he's going up, you know, I mean, when you talk about that 100 before, you know, that quick 100 in Perth, that was off Vinay Kumar, who, you know, all respect to Vinay Kumar as a T20 bowler, you know, it's almost like picking a meter bowl in test level, the sort of penetration that he has. And also,
in fairness, that innings against Pakistan last year, wonderful though it was, again, how many bowlers did they actually have? They went in with a three-man attack. This is an India side that went in with five, didn't they? That's
going to have
a big difference.
Exactly. They're going to have two Hall of Fame spinners already, and Bumrah, and whichever fit bodies they can fit around that. That's a good attack.
Where's Stuart Binney?
I think he was playing for Beckenham last year, wasn't he? We could have got him watching. You know, I think when it comes down to it, if you look at the way that what Warner can do, he can score 30 or 40 runs quite quickly. We talk about his strength and his power, but he's actually the best runner between wickets in the world. He's brilliant at finding gaps. He can, when bowlers bowl that hard back of the length delivery to him, he just flicks it through mid wicket for two over and over again. It does get him out sometimes, but it means that the bowler doesn't have that dry spot to bowl to him. You can't really bowl full and wide. If you bowl short, he's a chance of hitting a couple of fours and sixes from that as well. He really does limit your options. And the flow-on effect from that is Wade has done an incredible job. Wade should not be opening in a test match. Wade doesn't have the technique or probably the temperament to do it. But Wade is just, you know, he's like an old Western character, really. He's, you know, he's always mid-spit. He's always angry at someone. And he has the ability to do that. And at the other end is Joe Burns, who, I mean, I don't know if I've never seen a batsman just sort of fall off the cliff the way that poor Joe Burns has at the moment. People are saying he should never play for Australia again. I'm like, I don't care if he plays for Australia again. Just give him a break right now is what he needs. He needs to be on a beach somewhere with a pina colada, not with a bat with it, you know, facing Bumrah. So I think, you know, Wade is trying to hold on. What they just need is to be able to put a little bit more pressure back on India. At the moment, they don't, with Smith not making any runs, Marnus being a bit up and down. I mean, Marnus has not really made a lot of runs and has been incredibly lucky in this series. They only really have three guys of sort of international quality batting. What Warner can do is, even if he gets a 40 or 50 balls, he's going to give a different dynamism. He's going to change the way that the Indian bowlers have to bowl, and Australia will be back in the game a little bit then. And at the moment, it's like Wade is holding on. Burns isn't there at all. Marnus is getting dropped a lot. There's nothing to put any pressure back on India. And if you look at the Australian batting lineup, it's really interesting. They brought Cameron Green in, and they're massively keen on Cameron Green. I mean, Kerry O'Keefe was saying last night he could average 30 with the ball and average 40 with the bat. And I went, yes, he could be the fifth best all-rounder in the history of the game. I mean, that's possible, I suppose. Let's not put too much pressure on him. But there's one thing that you have to note about Cameron Green is he's an incredibly defensive batsman. He has been at first-class level and he is at test level. Tim Payne, everything we know about Tim Payne is he's basically very hard to get out. He doesn't make a lot of runs, but he's hard to get out. That means there's no real batsman there that can put any pressure back. Travis Head, in some kind of form, perhaps could. Warner changes that, and he does change the way the team is. And I think because of that, Warner could help. But you're right. I mean, he's not coming back against, you know, average attacks. He's coming back against a very good attack who are, you know, playing very good cricket. And he's got Ashwin bowls beautifully against Warner. And Bumrah should be the kind of bowler that should trouble him as well. So it'd be very interesting to see what happens.
The thing with Warner, Warner gives you an X factor that the opposition bowlers don't want to bowl at. But you think, who would I rather bowl at, Burns or Warner? I would actually, if I was Langer, I'd be getting into his ear. Because I actually think the Warner stuff is, has he not so much dropped off a cliff as in, I think psychologically, is it a point where he's got a few quid in his pocket now? He's playing all these things around the world. Is he comfortable with his life? He's not... That dog, that Jack Russell that came in at the start of his career that had to fight for everything, and he really had a go at everybody and he wanted to pick a fight, and he was hungry to play cricket. Has his hunger dropped a little bit because of the amount of money he's earning from playing around the world? And that's where I'd be getting into David Warner if I was Justin Langer and saying, look, put all that to one side. Go back to the dog that picks a fight. Go and pick a fight with 11 Indians. Go and pick a fight with people. Go and have a go at the umpires. Go and be David Warner that you were, rather than this Mr. Nice Guy who seems to be not getting any runs who doesn't seem to have that fighting again. Because that's the Warner that Australia need.
I think that they did that. And within 12 months, he was getting Cameron Bancroft to rub sandpaper on a ball. He changed. He did change. He went from the mad dog to
Warner. I'd rather have that Warner every day of the week.
It's still David Warner, isn't it? And you'd certainly see him in that side ahead of Joe Burns. And look, a session of Warner and Wade at the start of an innings, that's the game going back Australia's way, isn't it? Look, I'm just pleased that we've still got another couple of tests. You know, unless India win the third test match, this series is alive, of course. India holds the trophy after beating Australia last time out. But look, I'm just really, really happy. Firstly, Australia lost, and secondly, we've got two more tests to look forward to. What is it about Australia-India clashes? They are, forget the Ashes, they're the best. Jared, let you get some sleep. We'll chat to you soon. Harmeet, we will chat very shortly out of the break about the late, great Robin Jackman. You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2. Now, a chance to listen back with some sadness to an interview that took place at the start of the year, January, in Cape Town, between Mark Nicholas, part of the TalkSport 2 commentary team, cricket commentary team, and sadly, the late, great Robin Jackman. Jackers was in town, or rather, we were in his town, and during a lunch interval in the Test series between England and South Africa, and he joined us to look back at his career, as well as discussing many, many other tales. Hostile West Indies attack, the future of Test cricket, and talent spotting a certain Jack Callis. So sit back and enjoy as we remember the late Robin Jackman, who passed away sadly on Christmas Day, the age of 75. You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2.
This remarkable career of yours that's taken you to South Africa and has become your home. Your Cape Town life is, well, it's a wonderful place to live in so many ways. You played cricket here. I mean, you've had quite a journey in your career, haven't you?
I can't think of, if I had to do it again, I'd do it in a heartbeat, because it's to have a passion for something like I do for cricket and you do for cricket, and be able to stick with it for as long, with beyond your playing days, all right, when you're playing and so on, but to be able to get involved either in coaching or in broadcasting, as the case with both of us, it's almost a privilege to be able to stay in touch with something that you really love. And it's been a great journey. It's taken me all over the world, and I've places that, like the Caribbean, you know, it's quite expensive to go to the Caribbean, but when you're getting paid to go there, it makes it that much easier.
You did cause quite a rumpus when you went there, though, didn't you?
I mean,
you
the first
got thrown
time,
out
yes.
of Guyana.
Yeah.
I mean, you
dismissed.
Had these connections with South Africa, disgraceful for you. You were making an England debut at 35, I think I'm right in saying, in theory, and it was curtailed because they didn't want you in Guyana. It was only when you got more sympathy from the politicians in Barbados that it finally happened.
Yeah, it was. That was an interesting little spell. I've got to say that the MCC, which were the colours we were playing under then, were quite strict about exactly what would happen. If Guyana didn't want me, then the whole team would go home. But it wasn't that simple, because all the islands, as you know, have independent governments and so on and so forth, so they could make up their minds as to whether they were prepared to carry on with the series. And fortunately for me, it did carry on, because I played my first test match in Barbados on that trip.
Yeah, there was a tour led by Ian Botham, and a very difficult tour. West Indies were a phenomenal side. You were playing against the greatest collective fast bowling attack there's ever been, and a bunch of batsmen such as Viv Richards and Gordon Greenidge and Clive Lloyd, who are amongst the greatest players that have ever been. So, with respect to your fast bowling skills, what, you're just a midget. You're 5'9", aren't you? Or something, I mean, please.
It was green, so
it
gave me a little bit
was
of...
Was it really?
Oh, not half. How many... It was fluorescent green.
Okay. Mm. For their quicks, did you take wickets? Tell the world about your bowling in that match.
I got a wicket with my fifth ball in Test cricket.
Which was who?
Greenidge.
I think. Pretty good.
It was one of them. It was Greenidge or Haynes. It was one of them.
He could bat that Greenidge, didn't he?
And he's just been knighted,
yes,
I noticed.
Yes, I saw that, yeah.
So is Sir Clive. Sir Clive Lloyd also. So the three people you mentioned are knights of the realm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a hard test match for us, because we'd put them in. We won the toss and put them in. And they got enough. You know, they got 200 or whatever. I think, you know, somebody probably phoned me back and say, no, you didn't. You batted first. And because I'm not very good on statistical memories. All I can recall thinking to myself, and I was always quite a positive cricketer, I always felt that, you know, nothing was insurmountable. But my messages going home were, I don't see how we can win this test series. I don't see how we'll have enough time to get 20 wickets in the day, or in the game, not in the day, in the game. Because you could bowl as many bounces as you like then. And if you couldn't hook, you couldn't score. And so it was a case of survival to a degree, even for the best of the batsmen. And you couldn't score at any sort of rate to advance the game to give yourself time to get 20 wickets. So
remind us of the West Indies bowling attack.
Oh, it was very ordinary. Holding.
Bowling beaten for pace there. There was a quick delivery from Michael Holding.
Garner.
And he's bowling too. And Garner's having a ball out there.
Roberts.
And it's a wicket, and it's Andy Roberts' fifth wicket of the innings, rounding off a wonderful day's bowling.
Croft.
And that Croft was nasty.
Oh, we had a friendly warm-up game. When the tour would continue, we had what they labelled as a friendly in Barbados, and that bowling attack was Marshall, Clark, Hartley Elaine, I think.
Daniel.
And Daniel.
Wayne Daniel.
Yeah. Useful.
Yeah. How about now? John's just been on and tells me you've got Greenidge and Haynes. He just looked it up, and Clive Lloyd.
Ooh. All in the same innings.
So you were christened by Alan Gibson, the cricket writer, the Shoreditch Sparrow. But you never came from Shoreditch.
No, I didn't. I think it was something to do... I think he felt, for some unknown reason, I was reasonably theatrical on the field.
But he were.
Correct.
Anybody and, applauded, you used to shout, thanks, Mum.
Yeah. Yeah, she was always there.
Yeah.
And there apparently the Shoreditch Sparrow was an actor in the local theatre or whatever, so...
Surrey cricket's in great shape. I mean, you're probably well aware of that. You played in a tremendous side when you emerged as a young cricketer in the mid-60s. You've seen cricket in so many decades. It was the game of black and white TV in the mid-60s, and you came on the back of real luminaries, didn't you? A Surrey side of people like Peter May and Alec Bedser and Jim Laker and Mickey Stewart. Surrey cricket is an enormously strong part of English cricket at large.
I think there was a time when people used to say if there aren't players from Surrey and from Yorkshire in the England team, then the England team's a weak team. I think that was very true to a degree. Surrey won a championship 8 years running in, or 7 years running in the 50s, and then Yorkshire sort of took that over. But those names that you mentioned are so familiar, not just because they were wonderful cricketers, but because they were just about still on the staff when I was having trials and things like that. Kenny Barrington, Peter Loader, Roy Swetman. You know, it was really something to suddenly find yourself amongst these amazing players.
And then when you came here in the early 70s, the standard of domestic Currie Cup cricket was so strong, wasn't it? So many fantastic South African players emerging in what then became, over the 70s and 80s, the strongest, perhaps, collective group of South African cricketers ever.
I think you're right. It's a tragedy that that team wasn't exposed more across the world, because I would love to have seen how the South African side of the 70s would have gone against Australia and would have gone against England and the West Indies. But that wasn't to be, and because of the apartheid situation and getting kicked out of the game for 20 years. But the experience out here wasn't just Currie Cup cricket. I came here in 1968 because I turned pro in 65 and I wasn't going anywhere. I wasn't getting into the Surrey side that much, and I thought I needed to get out of England in the winter and go and play somewhere, wherever, and to get better, to improve. And through Jeff Howard, who was the secretary of Surrey at the time, he had a contact out here, and I came out and played for Cape Town Cricket Club. And overseas players weren't allowed to play in the Currie Cup at that stage. But to give you an idea of how strong club cricket was, the first game that we played was against Stellenbosch University. Eddie Barlow opened the batting. Andre Brains came in number 3. Mike Proctor came in number 5 and pushed off the sight screen when he wasn't back. I mean, I thought, well, this is club cricket.
Yeah, that's right.
I've come to a good place.
Yeah, interesting. I played here in 89, and we played in a 60-over competition semi-final against the university side. And there were 19 first-class players on the field. We opened the bowling with Garth LaRue and Stephen Jeffries. And then Mia's first change, frightening.
As Hilfenhaus continues, and now Callis brings up the three figures. He's all class, Jack Callis.
You uncovered a lot of players. You didn't only play here. I'll come back to Rhodesia in a second, but while I'm on the subject of Western Province, where you began here, you then became coach, and you were very responsible for the first part of the careers of guys like Gary Kirsten and Jacques Cullis.
Yeah, I can't claim Jacques. He was still at school when that was going on, and Duncan Fletcher.
You rang me about him.
Was his mentor. I told you.
You rang me. You said there's a boy playing here who's going to be as good as Barry Richards. Mm.
Well, the late Hilton Ackerman and I went to Wynberg Boys High School. And this 13-year-old, he'd just gone into the senior school, was in the nets. And he couldn't make a bulge in the netting. But everything was perfect, absolutely perfect. And he bowled some seamers, nice sort of action, good seam position. And that's it. And as we left the school, Hilton said to me, "We've just seen a future test player, without a shadow of a doubt." And he was that stylish then. And then, of course, he grew as a man. He was only a little reed of a boy at 13, and he grew and started to be able to hit it off the square. My goodness me, didn't he do it well?
And he's gone, he's nicked it. Hughes is out, and have a look at Robin Jackman. He is over the moon. He's got him, he's bowled him off the inside edge, and look at Robin Jackman and the English players running from everywhere. Chapel out without scoring, and Robin Jackman really striking back for England.
Jackman to Vessels.
And he's knocked him over. A beautiful delivery through to the fence. A couple of vessels, and look at Robin Jackman. And why shouldn't he be excited? He's put England in with a real chance at 5-77. You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2, and the second part of a very special interview from earlier in 2020 between Mark Nicholas and the late great Robin Jackman during a lunch interval in the Test Series between South Africa and England. And they discussed a whole host of topics. And after he passed away at the age of 75, we remember his extraordinary career But here he begins by discussing the former South African quick, Werner Verlander.
Where do you put Werner Verlander in the pantheon? 220 odd wickets at 21 and a half? I mean, it's jaw dropping, isn't it?
And he's retiring.
Shame, isn't
it? Can you believe it? He's really proved that with a bit of hard work. When he started out, he was a little bit more overweight than he should have been. And, you know, one or two people had a word with him and said, you know, if you want to play this game properly and at a top level, you're going to have to do a bit of work. You get yourself really fit and practice more than you are and so on and so forth. And give him his credit, he took it on board. And he's turned into one of those. He's almost, I don't know, is he comparable to Richard Hadley? Is that?
Well, he isn't as quick as Hadley. I mean, funny enough, I think he's comparable to James Anderson.
Okay.
I think they're sort of similar. They both take their wickets by pitching the ball up and moving the ball. They use skill as their first weapon rather than speed. They both have good brains for the game. They both have staying power. I think he might be a little more brilliant with using the Kookaburra ball than Anderson, but Anderson in English conditions is almost without compare. I'm just sort of rather in awe of his record. I mean, he's played cricket all around the world. He sort of trundles in, doesn't he, and lets it go at about 125, 130 and gets everybody out.
He gets top players. He gets the top order out, which is fantastic. The other thing I wouldn't mind knowing if I was one of these research boffins is how many fivers he got in his first 10 test matches. He just kept knocking teams.
Did he storm the game, didn't he? Well, yeah, he did, yeah.
And he went to places like New Zealand, which, okay, there might be a little bit of grass there. There isn't a great deal of pace in those pitches, and he did well there. And he didn't let himself down on the subcontinent.
No, it's interesting. Yeah, it's fantastic to think that your period from mid-60s to now involved with cricket, you know, seeing it up close and personal. And yet things like figures don't change, you know. They're the best bowlers getting his wickets at 21 and a half. So too the best bowlers of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 from Fred Truman, who you would first admired, who took him at about that rate through Malcolm Marshall all the way through to now. And when you watch the game today, do you still like cricket as much as you ever did?
Yes, I do. I hesitated for a second because there are three different formats now, and another one coming in England shortly. But this game that we're here to do is still, to me, the ultimate test. I did a little function last night for Lords Taverners South Africa, and Michael Atherton very kindly agreed to come along and have a chat as part of the entertainment to the dinner. It was a fundraiser for Lords Taverners. And my final question to him was the future of Test cricket and what does he think of the four-day game being passed by the various countries and therefore Test cricket coming down to 4 days instead of five. And he did a very interesting thing. He said, before I answer you, Jackers, there were 200 people in the room. How many of you in the room would like Test cricket to change from 5 days to four? Not one hand went up. Mind you, it wasn't a youthful room, which might have something to do with it, but not one hand went up. And I thought to myself, I don't want that to happen because I've seen so many brilliant fifth days. And on top of that, you need 5 days quite often purely because a day gets rained out somewhere or you lose a lot of light, particularly in Asia. It gets dark very early. And so you kind of need that extra time.
That was a good point. Vernon took, wait for this, four fivers in his first six.
Six tests. His first six innings.
And 51 wickets in his first seven matches. 51 wickets in the first seven test matches.
It's phenomenal.
Just by wobbling it around on a length.
Yeah.
That is skillful, isn't it? That's pretty.
He reduced Australia to 21 for 9 here.
Who come on, the best players you've come on, you've got to tell us, best player you ever bowled at?
B.A. Richards.
And you got him out more than anybody else. Do you know that?
Yeah,
certain
I do.
Times.
I do. It was in his book,
I think
actually.
You told me, actually.
Yeah, I probably did. But it's interesting. It's quite interesting because who was it who wrote Barry's book, Played for Hampshire?
Andy Murta.
Andy Murta. He got hold of me and he said, would you like to contribute somewhere along the line? And I said, sure, here's a contribution. And I gave it to him. And he printed it word for word. And yes, I played against Barry more than most people because I played against him in the Currie Cup here and Surrey versus Hampshire in England. So yes, I did happen to get him out more often than any other bowler. But I think he averaged 87 or 85.
Right, okay. good qualification.
It was like Court Dupree bowled Jackman 172 and so on, and so it went on.
You obviously know who got me out in the last game we played against each other.
Sylvester Clough.
You.
Shame.
The late, great Robin Jackman in conversation with our very own Mark Nicholas. If you missed any of the interview or wish to catch up, you can download the podcast from the following on feed, available on Apple Podcasts, Acast and Spotify. Thanks for listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.